It is indeed county fair season around the region. People who have nothing to do with livestock or horses or horticulture show up for the fun parts of fairs, the rides and carnivals and food. Not to say the other parts aren't fun, too, but lots of people show up for rides and carnivals and food. We'll focus on the carnivals of several decades ago in this hour with someone who worked them. There is no insinuation that this kind of thing happens today, but our guest worked in a time when his job was separating people from their money. Peter Fenton is the author of a book called Eyeing the Flash, The Making of a Carnival Con Artist. Peter Fenton worked for tabloid newspapers for 15 years. Leading him to write one of his books called Truth or Tabloid. He's also the co-author of I Forgot to Wear Underwear on a Glass-Bottom Boat. Peter lives in Eugene. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. I have to ask if there's a direct connection between a carnival con man and tabloid writer.
Well, there actually is. It was sort of my calling card. I sent them the National Enquirer was the tabloid that I worked for. After I did the carnival business, and I thought one day, well, maybe your readers might be interested in learning about how carnival games are fixed. And so I sent that off, didn't expect to hear back from him, and I instead got a call back from a young editor, and he said, would you like to write for us? And I am a writer by trade, and so I said, okay, and that launched myself and my wife on a 15-year career writing human interest stories and about UFO aliens and all that sort of thing. So it was a lot of fun.
Well, so you did actually talk to people. It wasn't like the stories were made of whole cloth, but the fact is that you tended to embellish the stuff you had.
Right. Yeah. We just actually the book, the one you talk about, Truth or Tabloid, was it was a game as well as a book. And the game was, and what I did was rewrite true stories from, let's say, the New York Times or Washington Post in a tabloid fashion, and then have other stories that I made up out of whole cloth, and people had to guess which were true and which were tabloid. And when you write in the tabloid style, even though it's the truth, it can seem like it is not. So we didn't necessarily make up stories, but that you can make anything seem like it's fake if you write it in a certain manner with a lot of hyperbole.
I did look at some of the truth or tabloid examples. It was hard to tell which was which. Yeah,
right.
So, Peter, how did you come to work for a carnival as a teenager?
Well, I was just a shy kid in high school. I think I was about 15 years old at the time. And I had a math class with another guy who was quite tall. You know, he was already at 6 feet tall, maybe taller, and I would be the person who's always answering the questions correctly and, you know, first to raise my hand and so forth. And so he approached me one day after class and started talking to me about what he was up to and about the carnival business and how he wanted to start a casino in his basement that we would allow our fellow high school students to come over and play. And I was pretty excited about it because of my shyness. You know, I was looking for a way to break out of that. And he was the opposite of me, quite extroverted. And so I thought this might be somebody to hook up with and send me off in another direction.
In a sense, was it like running away to join the circus? I mean, was that big a change from what you'd been like before?
Yeah, it really was like running away from the circus, except I came home every night.
How unexpected was this in your family? I mean, your family was highly respected in small-town Mineralton, Michigan.
Yeah, it was very upsetting to them that I would align myself with a guy who was, if not from the wrong side of town, at least the wrong sort of enterprise. My friend's father owned the carnival that he worked on and also had a ride manufacturing business. So they were prosperous, but they were not the right kind of people, and my family wasn't very happy about that.
Give us a sense of the time and surroundings. I mean, this is around the mid-60s, like 1963 or so. This is almost Beatle time in USA. But
yeah, that's it. But around where we were, it was a small town. I call it Mineralton in the book, but it's a small town named Mount Clemens, which is about 20 miles outside of Detroit. And it was very much a small, isolated town, about 15,000 people at the time. I don't think the freeway was even between the two areas was even built by then. So you had to get back and forth on a four-lane road, and there were actually farms in between Mount Clemens and Detroit. So not much going on other than the for kids every year, the big excitement was a carnival would come to town. So that was sort of my first contact with something exciting and show business-like. And maybe that kind of got into my brain that this was something that I wanted to participate in, and that was fun, and it's the most colorful sort of thing that I had encountered up to that point in my life.
We've already gotten a physical description of the guy that you refer to as Jackie Baron in the book, but he was quite a character. I mean, what was he just like in addition to observing people who are good at math? He had some other attributes, too.
Oh, he was really good. He was a real showman. If you want to say he was a young Donald Trump, so that's basically how you could see him. He had his hair meticulously combed back.
You mentioned the smell of Vaseline. Vitalis, yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like his fingernails were manicured, and there were stories about him around the town that he had done all sorts of things that were that a lot of boys aspired to but hadn't been able to in terms of women and exotic sort of things.
That kind of guy.
And he also drove his own car even then, even though he wasn't old enough.
That's a pretty interesting development there. We'll get back and talk more with Peter Fenton about his life as a person conning people at carnivals when he was a teenager before he went on to work for the National Enquirer. Peter lives in Eugene, so he's part of our region. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join the conversation when we return at the Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Peter Fenton, a writer who lives in Eugene. He's written about a lot of stuff over the years and a whole lot of stuff that ended up in the National Enquirer, where he worked for 15 years. He tells us about his life at summer carnivals in his book, Eyeing the Flash, from 2005, The Making of a Carnival Con Artist. So how he came to separate people from their hard-earned money is the topic of the book. There's some really interesting writing and interesting circumstances in here as well. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about Jackie Baron. At least that's the name he goes by in the book. Some names have been changed to protect the guilty, I guess.
Yeah, that's about it.
But one of the things that quote unquote Jackie places to you is this question about life, sort of generally. Do you want to be an ulcer getter or an ulcer giver? You chose to be an ulcer giver.
Yeah, I chose. I said I've been an ulcer getter up to that point because of the nature of my family. You know, taking a lot of guff for my parents and elsewhere and other people. And so, and because of the shyness, feeling like I was kind of behind the eight ball. So when he put it to me that way, I had no choice but to say, I want to be an ulcer giver. And whatever that meant, I had no idea what the consequences of saying that were at the time, or the ramifications of that. But that was my decision.
So, you know, you mentioned that Jackie noticed you in math class. You figured you were good at math, which certainly is a good skill for somebody to have when they're trying to work some numbers with people.
Yes.
But when I think about the fact there could have been lots of kids who were good in math class and raised their hand a lot, there must have been something else he saw in you, which raises the question whether he saw you as something of a mark of his own.
Yeah, I think he saw me both as a mark and someone who could work with him and help him out. So it was always a mixed bag in terms of the relationship. At first, I just thought it was pure friendship and that he admired me for my skills and I was going to help him out. But as I moved on throughout the carnival, and I found that I was also being exploited by the person I had considered my great friend at the time.
So did he sort of unfold things to you slowly as he first got to know you from math class, or did he let you know right away that he was involved in an operation where he made money off of tricking other people?
Yeah, I found that out pretty early on. The first step was setting up this, what we called the casino in his basement, where we had traditional gambling games that you would run into at in Las Vegas or Reno, and yet we operated them in the way that they don't in Reno, which is we had them all fixed so that the percentages were far in our favor, so, and we would win and control the games completely.
So your odds were even better than in Reno and Las Vegas.
Oh,
as,
yeah,
as the house, yeah.
You're right. That, yeah, we had the house odds operating for us, and then we had little gambits like actual marked cards, and so we knew what the other people were getting, and we also had Eddie's skill at throwing dice. He was able to throw them, palming one of them and tossing them out to make it look like they were clattering and tumbling over and over, but the one of the dies would just slid along the felt. Now, these are sort of things that if you played them with, you attempted them with people who knew anything about gambling, you'd wind up with your fingers smashed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're working them with high school kids, as we did, our peers, they didn't notice.
Wow. So, and this is stuff I assume he learned from his parents, who ran what you call party time shows.
Yes. Yeah, his parents had grown up in what Carney's called show business. They started out small. They were from different families and different Carney families, and then they kind of had a marriage of both. I don't know how much romance there was to the marriage, but they married their various cons together and eventually put together party time shows, which is a very small carnival that traveled around Michigan and Ohio.
Peter Fenton, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He wrote a book called Eyeing the Flash, The Making of a Carnival Con Artist. So he's telling us about some of the secrets of working carnies years ago. How does one train somebody to fleece people at a carnival? I mean, the basement of your home when you got a bunch of high school friends is one thing, but you're taking this in the public into a less controlled environment. So I'm curious to know what some of the opening steps were for you.
Well, for me, he said, okay, now we're going to go out in the carnival. It's spring. And I'm going to start you out slow on a very, very, I mean, it was like training for any kind of job. So he started me out at the most basic level, which was the children's games, the balloon toss, and then picking up a duck out of a pond. I don't know if people are familiar with those, but they're just very, very simple games where a mom will bring a five-year-old and give you a quarter or 50 cents, and then they'll pick up a duck, and under the duck, the plastic duck, is a number that corresponds to a prize that they can win. And so that was my early training, and the gimmick or the gaff there, as they call it, was that there were behind me in the booth would be an array of prizes, some of them quite large. The large ones, which are called spoofers, did not have a number. The ducks that were floating around wouldn't have the number that corresponded to that spoofer.
You could never win the gigantic stuff.
So you could never win the gigantic prize unless I wanted you to, and I would do that, let's say, with what they call a shill, somebody from the show who would walk by and give you a quarter, then you'd put the plastic duck into the water that corresponded to the big prize, and then you would allow him or her to win that. Then they would walk around the midway and tell everybody, hey, I want it over there, that's great, and they'd shout and hoot and holler, and that would help build what's called a tip, which is a large crowd.
Oh, so you really just needed the person to parade around with the gigantic stuffed gorilla or whatever and say, oh, yeah, this is great, I got this over there.
Yeah, that would help, yeah. And otherwise, it was just something that... Because it was a children's game, and mom wanted to have the kids play one game, you also got a regular stream of people coming in, regardless of how well you promoted it.
So before we even get into many of the mechanics of what you guys did, I mean, help pull the psychological lid off this for the general public. I mean, why do people work so hard and spend so much to get a stuffed animal they could probably buy at a store for a couple of bucks?
You know, that I still have no answer to that question. I don't know. It might be just there's a suspension of disbelief when you enter the carnival midway with all the noise, the color, the sounds of people having fun, and so you may just say, oh, so you kind of put your good sense, you leave it at the entrance to the midway when you walk in, and do a lot of things that you wouldn't other in another context. If it was presented to you just cold, you would not even bother with this. You wouldn't even want the stuff that you're playing for and spending money on. Yeah.
In those early heady days with piles of money coming in from events like the casino night in the basement, how was your conscience doing?
Well, I figured you'd ask that question, and I have to really say that I wasn't bothered at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was a teenager. I was so caught up in my own growth, you know, that opportunity that this would afford me, that all I wanted to do was learn it well and execute the tricks just as they needed to be. So I was just really caught up in my own. So basically the bottom line is that for me it was therapeutic and a growth experience at the expense of other people. I mean, I can't say it any other way.
Indeed, at the expense of other people. Peter Fenton, who lives in Eugene, wrote the book Eyeing the Flash, The Making of a Carnival Con Artist. The book came out about 11 years ago, and it talks about Peter's time working for a carnival in Michigan and Ohio back in the 1960s. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what are some of the other tricks of the trade, the kind of things to get people hooked, to keep them spending, or to get them over to the games booth at the carnival in the first place?
Yeah, well, to get them over in the first place, you have what is termed a call. In other words, that's what you say to the person to bring them over. It can be anything from, hey, come on in, it's time to win, to things that are more personalized to the individuals who are walking by. Hey, I like your shirt. Let me ask you about that. I got a question for you. Hey, you know, where do you go in this town to have some fun? That's what, anything to just drag the person over. So it doesn't have to be specifically about the game itself, just a way to get people over. And sometimes you simply mumble something and they say, what? Well, come here a little closer. You probably can't hear me because the, you know, the Ferris wheel is too loud or something like that. So once you get them over, then you start explaining the game. And you always begin by giving them on the more gambling sort of games that go beyond the children's games. You give them a free try, and you let them win on that free try. And then just to get them started, prime the pump. Not everybody moves on beyond that first stage, but that doesn't matter. There's a lot of people on the midway, and what you're concerned with is catching a live one, as they call it, or a mark, somebody who's going to go beyond the next step and invest some more money in the game in an attempt to win a teddy bear or a glass bowl or something else that, you could get a Kmart or something for a tenth of the price.
You know, when I think about the kinds of games that I've seen at Carnival Midways, you know, some of this, I'd love to have a tape measure out there to measure actually how big those rings are that you're trying to throw around the necks of bottles, because I get the feeling there's not a lot of space between, and so it makes it really hard to do. But so was there one game that you supervised that worked better than just about any other?
Well, they all worked well in their own way. There basically are three different types of games on the Midway. One is the Hanky Pank. It's called the Hanky Pank, which is the children's games that I mentioned. The next up is the Alibi games. Now, those are ostensibly games of skill that, like throwing, knocking down the milk bottles or putting the basketball through the hoop, other ones that are quite esoteric, dropping a softball that seemingly simple, dropping a softball in a basket and having it remain in the basket. So the idea of the alibi is that the carny, the agent, always has an excuse why the person didn't succeed. In other words, you're trying to knock the milk bottles down. Oh, you threw it too light. You got to throw it harder. And if they throw it hard, you say the opposite. There's always some thing where you are acting as if you're trying to help the person win by refining their skill. And the fact is that they're not going to win. As a general rule on the games, it's kind of counterintuitive. People think, oh, they're fixed. You're preventing me from winning. No. The carny does is the fix is in when you're manipulating the game. You're allowing them to win. When they initially come in, I would throw a lever or you do this or you do that, that lets them win. Then, as they go on, they get more and more involved in the game. You don't touch the game. You can stand 20 feet away, and because of the nature of the game, they will never win. When it's on the natural, as it's called, it's impossible to win the game. So in other words...
So the fix is always in. You just make it so it's not sometimes.
Yes, right. That's the fix is always in, and I make it so it's not. So that's way also if you get heat, or in other words, somebody calls a policeman over or something, then you can say, well, what am I doing here? I'm standing 10 feet away. I'm not doing anything, and it's just it's not happening for them. I tried to advise him. I tried to help the guy, and it didn't work. And so again, it's the opposite of the way most people think, that things are fixed. It's fixed. I throw the fix when to allow you to win.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned hanky-panky and alibi. What was the third category again?
The third one is called a flat store, and that's the sort of the pinnacle of the carnival world, and that I finally entered after a couple of months of apprenticeship on the other games. I was allowed to work that, which was kind of controversial among the other carnies because they were all veterans, and I was just a kid. They called me at the time. I was the youngest so-called flat store agent in the country. Now, how that could be approved, I have no idea, but that's what they said. And that one, it's quite hard to explain. It's a much more complicated game, but it boils down to gambling, or the semblance of what appears to be gambling, but it is not, because you're not going to win. The person, you start them off as if they're going to win a prize. You manipulate them into that they're going to win several prizes. And then you start to get into money. Well, I'll tell you what, if you keep going here, I'm going to be fair. I'm going to put in some money. I'm going to put in $10. And then if you win the game, you get the $10 plus these five great prizes. And the guy says, oh, that's great. And then he starts to play, and I say, wait a minute, no, I add, so you have to add. It's, you got to put up the $10 too. That's only fair, right?
Upping the ante.
Upping the ante, yeah. And then you're off and going, and then you kind of improvise. Then you say, well, it's $20 to play this time, and you get all your money back, and so on and so forth. So this can add up to quite a bit of money that you get from the individual, hundreds of dollars. And legend has it, and it probably is only legend, that one guy lost $50,000
wow.
playing this game once. But I've never seen anyone get anywhere near that.
Peter, you're not telling anybody things that we've never heard before, I guess. And you mentioned that there are people who think, well, the game is fixed. So there's always that suspicion. And I wonder if part of the reason that people go to booths like this on the Carnival Midway is because they think they can beat the system, or they just want a thrill, kind of like the people who are going to go on the Ferris wheel right next to the Midway.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, somehow people think you go on a carnival and it's all fixed, and there's something transgressive about it or cheeky about saying, I know this is fixed, but I'm going to play the game and just see what happens. The problem is that some of these people get caught up in it, and it goes further, and they actually lose much more than the original 50 cents they thought they'd invest in it. So, again, the whole psychological makeup of the so-called mark is something I don't get. Now, one thing you might consider is this, is that there's an old saying that, you know, the con artist only succeeds because of the greed of the mark. So there's something that kicks in, and carnies, as you know, probably know, are supposed to be stupid dummies, and so people come to that, to the carnival with that attitude that I'm going to, this guy is so stupid, I'm too easy, I'm going to take him for his money, and it doesn't work that way.
A contest of wits, and we think that we come in with more wits than the folks who work for the carnival. We're talking to Peter Fenton about his book, Eyeing the Flash, his years working as a carnival con artist in his teens. Back in the Midwest, you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Peter and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're spending this hour, in a sense, on the Carnival Midway with Peter Fenton of Eugene, an author who spent his teen years working for a carnival in the Midwest. He's written a book called Eyeing the Flash, The Making of a Carnival Con Artist. It's been out on the bookshelf since 2005. Peter also worked for the National Enquirer for 15 years, so he's got a little experience in the world hyping things just a bit, and he's giving us some secrets of what went on behind the scenes at the carnival back in the day. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 to ask questions or share experiences. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Anne. I suspect this is Anne and Eugene. She writes, Eyeing the Flash is both my nephew's and son's favorite book. The only other competition is Norman MacLean's A River Runs Through It. Given the great that the author's a fellow Oregonian, love hearing his story. So there's a bit of fan mail for you.
Wow. That's a surprise.
Indeed. We have a phone call here, too, from Misha in Eugene. Welcome to the exchange with Peter Fenton.
Hi, Misha.
Speaking about that, I worked 1 year at the Lane County Fair, and there were two games. The one that people would throw the dime, and if it landed on the red, people could win big stuffed animals.
Yeah.
And I was working in that one and having some fun, but unfortunately I got moved to another booth. And that one, I'm not saying was a ripoff, but the other one, people would be like the darts, and people would get these prizes really not worth anything, and they'd have to, I'm not going to say ever popped a balloon for the people to help them out, but for the other one, people would have to spend $18 to win something, where the other one, these two guys won big stuffed animals just for like a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
The one was a thing where people could win something. The other one was more of a have to spend lots of money.
All right. Thanks for sharing the story, Misha. Appreciate that. Are sometimes the smaller games meant to be sort of like a gateway drug for the people who really want to take their chances, Peter?
Yeah, you could look at it that way. And they can win something there, and then they might go on to the stronger stuff. Now, just to follow up on what Misha was saying, talking about the various types of prizes, the smallest type of prize, the inconsequential prize, is called slum, and for good reason. You know, it costs a couple of cents. Then the next step up is the plush. That's your typical sized teddy bear. And then the big prize, the one that nobody ever wins, the big stuffed toy, is called a spoofer. And then on some of the gambling-type games, you'll have items, well, back in my day, like portable TVs or blenders and things that people could win. However, they never left the shelf. At the most, you would wind up taking the blender to your trailer, using it, cleaning it up, and putting it back on the shelf.
Okay, so all kinds of so I mean, I haven't asked about laws and what is supposed to protect people from getting gulled at operations like this.
Right. Well, to be honest, and again, this is back in the day, and I'm sure it doesn't happen anymore. But in the small towns, you would go in, and the head of the carnival, which was my friend's father, would patch the police. Now, what that meant is can mean a lot of different things. It can mean from an outright exchange of give money or giving him some free a bunch of free passes for his kids to go on the rides, or some spoofers. But essentially, it was a payoff to just go easy on the carnies if somebody started whining about losing money. So you largely the result is if the police would come in, they would basically admonish the mark or the player for being so stupid, and how could you get caught up in this thing, and then you came in to it with eyes open, and it's just your fault, and it's too bad. And so, yeah, that actually did happen. In other cases, nobody even knew about it because it's just some small little show on the side of the road, and nobody's paying attention.
Well, you know, I was careful to not give an insinuation that this kind of thing happens today, particularly as we're entering county fair season around the region. I mean, is this blatantly sort of rip-off-y kind of carnival like you worked at? Is it a rarer thing in today's world?
Yes, and even back then it was rare. If you go to the Jackson County Fair or the Lane County Fair, you're not going to see this type of operation. You know, it's all clean and on the up and up. But where you would have seen this type of show, and where you may see it even run into it today, is are on the in a parking lot somewhere when you're out on a country drive, or at a festival somewhere in a small town. And then what you wind up with there is you could have the potential for running into what was called a rackets show, which is that despite the fact that it has the rides and the corn dog sales booth, the primary purpose of it is to get people to play the games, make money, and get out of town. The other thing is that sometimes the games are simply held in tents or trailers, you can easily switch out legitimate games and then the fixed games on the final night you're in town, and because you're going to be in 5 hours, you're going to be packing up and moving on elsewhere. So it's kind of fluid. You won't again run into this at the county fairs, but it's still out there, and you may see it in some nook or cranny. And if you look for the types of games I've described, you could find them, and best bet is to stay away.
I was about to say that there's no secret to winning these, because you're not supposed to win. So
get
the corn dog and the Ferris wheel ride and get out.
Yeah, that's about it. Unless you get hooked and you say, "Well, I'm going to be the one person who actually defeats this carny who may not have a book education or may not have gone to school, but they definitely have street smarts and they know the game better than you do, and they know how to manipulate you much better than you think you might be able to. That you may think that you can't be manipulated, but that's not the case."
Let's take another call. We have Sheldon in Eureka on the phone. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Fenton. We're talking about conning people at carnivals back in the 60s.
Hi, Jeffrey. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, Sheldon.
Back in the early 80s, I used to work carnivals.
Yeah.
And I started out as a hanky pink agent, and
okay.
And there are some cats out there that are very good hanky pink agents, and before you know it, you're down $80,
yeah,
and your girlfriend's walking away with a teddy bear. But
right.
Then I graduated into the alibi joints, namely screw pool, which I'm sure that you're familiar with.
No, I didn't have that one actually. Yeah,
well, it's I'm not going to get into the details of it,
right.
But I used to go around. I was a free agent. I could, work anywhere I wanted to.
Yeah.
And I would look for the flat stores, and I'd know that it was a racket show.
Yeah.
And then I would look for, you know, what I did. And, you know, one of the things that he talked about calling in a mark, you know, what I would do is, you know, hey, you going that way? And they would say, what? And I said, excuse me, are you going that way? And then they come back, and then they have their girlfriend, and I say, here, take a free one or whatever. And then I would hand her the biggest stuffed animal that I had to hold on to.
Yeah.
Here, hold on to this while he wins
right.
it for you. Right?
That's a good one, yeah. But yeah. you don't get to walk away with it, but you can hold
no.
on to it for a while.
Yeah. Well, you know, in screw pool, with a lot of the alibi joints, you start them out at $2, and it goes, you know, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, and you keep going, and then finally they say, you know, all right, you have $32 invested in the game. What I'm going to do is when you win, you get your $32 back plus the big prize. And that goes
yeah.
to 64, 128, 256, 512. By the time they get to $512, they've won the prize, even though they haven't.
Right.
Sheldon, thanks for sharing the thoughts here on the exchange. You know, as we giggle through some of these sessions, I mean, we are talking about people losing their money, and I wonder if there is a certain... maybe not even that grudging respect for the carnies, because, you know, we think that they're the dummies who are seedy types who are on the road. But the fact is that we seem to have a level of respect for their ability to separate us from our money, and we're supposed to be the smart ones.
Yes. Yeah, they can actually do it. Now, there is one thing in terms of separating somebody from their money. There's an old carny saying that always leave them with a dollar for gas. And what's that? So that they can leave and take it out on the wall at home or... chop wood rather than taking it out on you.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always that risk. So it is it's quite a skill to tread that fine line between taking somebody's money and having them jump in the tent and chase you around.
Right. So I was going to ask then if you did have moments when you pulled back, I mean, in something other than, you know, fear of bodily harm, but I mean, if you saw somebody's financial circumstances and maybe guided them away from a con or let them win and
yeah,
get over with.
Right. I mean, you even initially when you're sizing up a person, you take that into consideration. You don't want to, you know, not going to try to do it with somebody who looks like in pathetic condition or something's wrong with them. You're never going to do that. I'd say, in general, the primary person that you're going for are a bunch of young men who swagger into the midway. They've had a couple of beers. They got their sleeves are rolled up, and they're showing off their biceps. And these are the guys who want to prove themselves, who think they're better than you. And you don't really have that much compunction against knocking them down a peg or two. Maybe it'll help them in their future to be a little more humble.
Right, yeah. They will get something other than peaking in high school or something.
Right, right, right.
So in a lifestyle like this, how much do you trust each other? Do carnies do some work on each other?
Oh, yeah. That's a constant thing that you have to be concerned about. One of the... typical gambits is when a guy's ready to leave the show, go off to another one, he'll come around and ask to borrow $20 from you, and after a while you learn not to give it to him because he's going around and doing that and asking it from everybody. And so his goal is to walk off the midway with $200-$300 and move on down the road. So you have to watch out, and there's always that pressure. There's always the sense that, you have to be cautious that a con is being pulled on you. And particularly, I would have to be concerned about that because I wasn't the typical carny. You know, I came from a different environment, so I was considered by them sort of mark as well. And always had to be on the alert for that.
Do you think you and the guy you call Jackie Barron in the book would have been friends without this financial relationship?
That's a good question. I wonder about that to this day. I think it was both. You know, we mixed friendship and business. So we were, in a sense, business partners, and it wasn't really 100% friendship, and it wasn't 100% a business relationship. So I don't know. If we had been friends outside of the carnival, it probably would have involved some other kind of scam or con.
So what did finish your days as a carny, Peter?
I simply went off to school. University of Michigan, and Jackie himself, he was going to go to Wharton School of Business. He turned around and went to, also a year after I did, to University of Michigan, got his MBA. Then he went, got his CPA and went on to work for one of the big eight accounting firms. And then I lost track of him. Then when he called me after the book came out, I found out that he was at the time, he was a professor in the business department at Wayne State University in Detroit. Yeah.
Wow.
He was a full professor. He specialized in small business advice, and a lot he would refer to his carnival background to use it, you know, for anecdotes and to illustrate a point. And he recently retired and moved on to Tampa, Florida.
And I noticed that you write in the later editions of the book that a couple of guys called you and claimed to be the Jackie Barron character, but this was the real one.
Yeah, this is the real guy. His actual name, if anybody wants to look him up, was Eddie King, K-I-N-G, and you might find one of his presentations on YouTube. I don't know if they're still up there, but they were at one time.
We'll keep an eye out for Eddie King. The book is called Eyeing the Flash, The Making of a Carnival Con Artist, and even if you learn nothing about carnivals, it's a fun read. Peter Fenton lives in Eugene and wrote the book, and it's been out for since 2005. Peter, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
All right, take care. And that'll do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. I want to remind you, we do have convention coverage on the News and Information Service between 5 and 8 p.m. tonight. That'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects at jeffexchange.org. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter as well. The Exchange is produced by Emily Curitan of JPR News, who also co-hosts Vents Day. Emily Pfeiffer is at the controls today, our student assistant. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time on The Exchange, and have a great day.